fiduciary to order. I want to welcome everyone here. We're going to have, I think this year, a very full schedule again. Probably going to end up with, would you say, Mr. Tedder, 400 or 500 bills again?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House and Senate Judiciary Committee's last session handled more bills than any other committee in the legislature, including Ways and Means Committee.
So you can look forward to many hours here. Remember that those 450 bills, I do have a black hole in my office. Some of them will not see the light of day. Just briefly, you know, this committee deals with a lot of bills, and some of those issues are the bills contain things that are principal positions that members of the committee and the public have and you have. We want to make sure we have a proper open process of the hearing so people can, you know, express themselves. We'll try to do that. You'll also notice, I believe, we only have three members that have been in the judiciary process before. Is that right? Four. And the rest of them are going to be new, so it's going to be a training session, and the job of the committee staff and the lobby and those people who want bills moved to work with all of us to make sure that we get those types of things done. And our subcommittee setup this year is much different, where I have two very able Democrats heading those subcommittees. And they were chosen for the reason that they do have honesty and integrity, and I think they're going to do an outstanding job and help move this process along a little bit better. And they'll actually free me up to do a little bit more work on some of the tough issues maybe outside of this room, but I do intend to be here as much as I can. And we're all going to be challenged. Some would say we already are challenged. I wanted to go ahead and give the committee members an opportunity to introduce themselves and tell us just a little bit about themselves, just a couple of minutes. And if it's all right, I'd like Representative Ackerman. You want to kind of start out, and we'll come right all the way across, a little bit about your background. And
sure. Do you want my usual campaign speech, my stove speech, or is that over?
If you can do it in 2 minutes.
I believe in short meetings and short speeches. I'm an attorney. I graduated from the University of Oregon Law School in 1963. I've had a general practice since then. I'm still active in the practice. I've had cases from criminal to civil law across the full breadth of, I think, most legal issues. This is my start of my third term and start of my third participation in the House Judiciary Committee, so I look forward to lending what skill I can to the committee and moving our bills out of the subcommittee in a clean fashion so when they come to the committee as a whole that we can expedite the process and get these bills onto the floor. I firmly believe that we should try to get the bills out, because I think the democratic process is thwarted if we don't move fast enough and keep bills in the committee, and ultimately they get killed because of lack of time.
Morning. My name is Andy Olson, and I retired about a year and a half ago with the Oregon State Police as a lieutenant down out of the Albany office. I spent 29 years with the state police and have been assigned, started in Albany, and then went to Klamath Falls, Cottage Grove, Beaverton, Salem, McMinnville, and then back to Albany. But during the time that I was with the state police, I had opportunity to teach classes in civil as well as criminal law to police officers at DPSST as well as with the Oregon State Police Recruit School. And I'm really looking forward to getting on board here with everybody and moving on.
Okay, I'll start with you, Linda, come around back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. I'm Linda Flores, and I represent House District 51, which is Clackamas, Damascus, Boring, Estacada. I am a lifelong Oregonian. I do know my way around the judicial process. I spent 18 and a half years as a legal technician with a sole practitioner attorney in East Multnomah County. And I do have 10 years of experience with the Federal Highway Administration, six of those having been in the legal counsel's office, and at the zenith, I might add, of environmental litigation. I did also have a year in private practice in downtown Portland where we did not so much criminal work, but I also do have some experience with some the criminal component, not in my personal family situation, however.
I'm Jeff Barker, and I'm in my second, this second term I've been in the legislature. I'm a retired police lieutenant from Portland, a little over 31 years. I started with the Oregon State Police, and once I learned to read and write, I went to work for Portland. And I learned probably more in one term on the Judiciary Committee than I learned in 31 years out on the street. So I'm really looking forward to getting to work here and getting going.
I'm Greg McPherson. I represent District 38, which is Lake Oswego and part of Southwest Portland. I'm a native Oregonian. I grew up on a dairy farm in Linn County, and I decided there's got to be an easier way. And what I found was becoming a lawyer, which I've been for later this year 30 years, practicing with the same firm, so a certain air of consistency, I guess, where my practice has been in the field of employee benefits and other business work that relates with that. I served on the Judiciary Committee last session, and I'm looking forward to a productive session again this year.
Okay, thank you. And I'm Wayne Krieger, and I'm from Gold Beach, Oregon. In my third session, and actually it is the second time I've been here. My freshman session I was here in Judiciary, of District 1 on the South Coast. I also spent 28 years with the Oregon State Police and spent 6 years on the Board of Forestry, 5 on OWEB. And it's kind of strange that for probably the first time that I can think of, we have more police officers on Judiciary than we do attorneys. Some people said, hey, that's good. But we'll see. But it's good to be here. I think we've got a good group of people, and I think they're going to work hard. Mr. Taylor, do you want to introduce yourself and then the staff?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Taylor. I've been here since 1987 with the Judiciary Committee. It's been just 18 years, and it's been a fun 18 years. Before that, I was in private practice in Portland. Before that, I was in Washington, D.C., where, among other things, I represented the U.S. Capitol Police. And then before that, I was in Boston, where I'm originally from. And how did I get to Oregon? I met my wife in the Georgetown tax program. She borrowed my tax notes, got a better grade than I did. And two courses, so I figured a great way to improve the Taylor gene pool. She was from Portland. Portland was a nice place. Houses were affordable in 1985, so we moved out here. I eventually came down here in 87. So, would I also like to introduce Joe O'Leary, who's sitting in the front. Joe, if you could stand up and give us a little bit of your background.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Joe O'Leary. I've been in private practice in Portland. Do I need to speak into the microphone?
Whatever.
I guess I've been in private practice in Portland for the last 4 years, doing mostly white collar criminal defense work, mostly in federal court, but a lot in state court as well. Prior to that, I was a staff attorney at Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland, and graduated from Lewis and Clark Law School. Been in Oregon now for about 10 years, and very pleased to be here.
We also have Heidi Mowat, who's down from the Multnomah DA's office. Heidi had a vacation plans that were set, I guess, about 6-7 months ago and paid for. She will be back next week. She is a long line of people who have come down from the Multnomah DA's office, very excellent assistant district attorneys. She will be back next week. She'll be primarily handling criminal work in the criminal subcommittee of the House. Joe will be primarily in the Senate, but what we do in Judiciary Committee, staff oftentimes follow bills. So Heidi will be taking House bills and then appearing in the Senate as staff person, and Joe will be doing the same thing. In addition, we have Sam Sears. Sam was hired last week. Sam had been an extern for us 2 years ago when he was in law school. Since then, he clerked for the Court of Appeals, and Sam will be here on the 19th because last Saturday he got married. And we didn't have the heart to tell him that the Judiciary Committee was more important than his honeymoon. So.
Wait.
Okay. Please, I didn't have the heart to tell him.
Make your hearing to make that decision.
Okay. And back there is Patsy Ward, who's been office manager with Judiciary Committee for, I think, what, 6 years now, Patsy? Patsy, if you could introduce the support staff, I'd appreciate it.
Hi, I probably know most of you people, but I have all new staff this session. Elizabeth Howe, is going to be working on the House side, and Elizabeth will be dealing with the criminal subcommittee and the full committee. In the front row, we have Luann Romig, and Luann will be taking the civil subcommittee. And on the end, Dale Penn, the second. Not to be confused with his father. And Dale will be handling the Judiciary Committee on the Senate side.
Okay, that's everybody except for Representative Garrard. We've gone around the table and kind of introduced ourselves and given our backgrounds just a little bit. Would you like to do that for us, please?
Well, I'm Representative Garrard from Klamath Falls, District 56, and I lost my cell phone last night, and that's what why I'm late this morning, is going through Sprint voicemail, which is a delightful thing when you know you're already late for something. So my brief background is 4 years as a county commissioner in Klamath Falls, Klamath County, and I'm in my third term as a state representative. I served on the Oregon State Bar Disciplinary Board for 4 years, and that's the extent of my legal experience. So, but I'm delighted to be here and look forward to the challenges this committee will meet during the session.
Okay, thank you, Bill. We're going to go into a work session, open that work session for the purpose of introduction of the committee rules. Representative McPherson, would you like to make the motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee rules that have been distributed to the committee and are before us this morning be adopted.
Okay, Mr. McPherson, Representative McPherson has moved the rules for adoption. Is there any discussion? Okay, those who are in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Would you call a roll on this time, please?
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
And I'm assuming Thatcher are excused.
Theoretically, they're excused. Okay, the motion passes. We also have possible measure introduction here. What do we have?
Chair, members of the committee, we have LC 892 relating to judgments sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary, LC 1425 on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, relating to penalties for driving while under the influence of intoxicants, LC 1426, once again on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, relating to revocation of driving privileges, LC 1513 on behalf of the Oregon Advocacy Center, relating to children's mental health, LC 1602 relating to recordation of instrument affecting real property, and this one is at the request of the Judiciary Committee.
That's five or six.
That's 1602.
Yeah. Well, how many total number bills? Five or six.
The count, Mr. Chair.
Simply, I've got five. I wonder if I missed one.
Okay. Five. Yeah. One, two, three.
Okay.
Five.
Mr. Chair, this is for the purpose of getting them into the process, but not necessary that you would be in favor of that legislation.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. This is solely to introduce the bills so that they will be printed, and traditionally it's never considered a indication of support or opposition to a bill.
Okay, Representative McPherson, would you make the motion to move them in block?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that the LCs that have just been described by committee staff be introduced as committee bills in block.
Okay. Representative McPherson has made the motion to accept those bills in block. Any discussion?
Call a roll on or just gavel them in.
You gavel them in. Yeah, probably do that. Okay, we'll move then. Thank you. We'll be going out of the work session and into an open informational meeting. Mr. Greg Perns, Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, please.
Thanks, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Craig Prinz, and with the chair's leave, I'll have our staff from the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee, Meredith Bud, you can call him Bud, Meredith Bliss, goes by Bud, come up with me. Mr. Taylor asked me to, well, first of all, it's nice to be here, and I'm honored to be, I think, the first person to testify to this committee this session. And I don't know, maybe I'm the first one to testify, you know, in any committee, but it's an honor to be here and give you some information. When Mr. Taylor asked me to come give some information on forfeitures, I think he did that because I have a new job as executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and within the Criminal Justice Commission is the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee, which Bud staffs, and that is a committee set up of, well, actually I checked to make sure that Representative Barker is still on that committee. There are six legislators on that committee, and then three members appointed by the governor and the AG, and the purpose of that committee is to provide oversight and policy recommendations for forfeitures. So that's why I say that, because I am certainly not an expert on forfeitures. This is part of my new job, and that's why I brought Bud to make sure he could answer. I told him I would offer him as a sacrificial lamb in case there's any hard questions. So,
thank you.
For those of you who are on the Interim Judiciary Committee, there was a, probably you had more experts that came and testified in April of 2004. And what I've done is put together a kind of a little synopsis, and then included all of the exhibits from that meeting, so that my thought is that you will, if you take this packet back to your staff and just put it into a file for forfeitures, you'll have that information when and if it comes up. Feel free to interrupt me anytime. I'm used to being. I don't. For those of you who don't know, I used to be one of the Judiciary Council for the last two sessions. So you know, I don't know if that. Just interrupt me anytime if you have any questions, and I'll just go through this as best I can. What you have is I tried to give a little bit of a background on forfeiture. Forfeiture goes back way back to biblical or medieval times, and I don't want to. Bud has put together some of that history, but what I think Mr. Taylor wanted me to do and why I'm here is to kind of give information on what you may be confronted with as some decision points this session. And so what I'm talking about when I say that is Measure 3 that was passed in 2000. So I'm just going to kind of give a quick background and then move into that. So there's this very long history of forfeitures, and there is a view of forfeiture that we call civil forfeiture that basically looks at the property that was used in a crime or used illegally. And in civil forfeiture, that crime is almost treated as the defendant, and it's called a in rem or regarding property action. And in that type of civil forfeiture, I guess the things that I would point out about that is the property is what is the defendant, basically. There's not a requirement that there be a conviction of a person in a criminal case for that property to be forfeited. And so the way it would work is in the past and in history was that that property would be seized and a forfeiture process would start, and you'd see it would look something like Lane County versus $5,000 of U.S. currency, and then there would be a forfeiture and counsel, and there would be a process to do that. I give that background because that really is the old way forfeiture was done. In 1989, the Oregon legislature passed a civil forfeiture statute. Prior to that, it was done locally. You'd have, each county would have what kind of local ordinances. In 89, that was consolidated so there would be one procedure throughout the state for civil forfeitures. And so that happened in 89. At that time, also, the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee was created. And again, that body is a group of legislators and appointees from the governor and the AG to oversee how forfeiture is done. Through the years, there have been amendments made in law in response to state and federal court cases, and these are amendments that basically were protections for innocent property owners and other parties in the system. Back in, I believe, 97, a law was passed to allow for what they call mitigation hearings, which would allow for a person who has an interest in the property that was forfeited to talk about mitigating circumstances and why what was forfeited would be excessive. And so that's kind of all background to what I wanted to, really I think what Mr. Taylor wanted me to talk about and highlight and why you might want to tuck away this information for the future. In the handout I gave you, you can see that Bud has put together some of the financial information on forfeitures, the value of the property that was forfeited, and you can see that in 99 and 2000, prior to the passage of Measure 3, in 99 it looks like the estimated value was $2.6 million approximately, 2000 it was $3.6 million. That money was used by law enforcement predominantly. Some of the money went to fund the Asset Forfeiture Committee. But mostly and predominantly was used by law enforcement to then have basically narcotics task forces that would investigate drug crimes predominantly. As you moved into the 90s and as the war on drugs expanded, basically, we came through to about 2000 when a reform movement throughout the country took place. There was a federal reform act, the Civil Asset Reform Act of 2000, but more importantly for our purposes, Measure 3 was passed. You may or may not, as the Property Protection Act of 2000. And that's really what I wanted to talk about today, because Measure 3 is currently before the Supreme Court of Oregon, and they are the prediction, I think Bud told me and some of the parties, is that a decision over whether Measure 3 is constitutional should be made spring of this year, so in the next few months. And that's before the court. I think that's right. I think they're thinking late spring. That's before the court on an issue that some of you are probably familiar with, which is whether it's a single subject or not. The reason I mentioned Measure 3 is Measure 3 really changed civil forfeitures in Oregon. It passed in 2000. I enclosed the body of Measure 3, which Dave Fedenke from the ACLU gave to the Interim Judiciary Committee in April of last year. And so you can look at Measure 3. Mr. Fedenke also gave you the how it passed in each county, the tally of the votes, and then statewide, I think it passed by a 67% of the vote. Measure 3 changed civil forfeitures dramatically. The most important change was that it would require a criminal conviction of the property owner rather than the old civil forfeiture, where basically it would just there would be a preponderance of the evidence, and it would basically, as I said, I think that the burden would have been on the property owner to prove that there was some legitimate reason that they could have for this property or currency. So I think that was the most salient point of Measure 3, that it required a conviction. It increased the standard of evidence to clear and convincing evidence. That also shifted the burden of proof to the government to prove that the items seized were the were either basically the proceeds or proceeds of illegal activity. The other main part of Measure 3 was that it said that law enforcement could not use that money for law enforcement activities, and changed that and directed them towards drug treatment. This was a huge change in forfeitures in Oregon, and I think since that time we've really, you know, forfeitures have really lessened, and the amount of property that's forfeited has lessened as well. The other thing, so that was Measure 3, and I think that forfeiture is really an issue that has kind of galvanized that there's two sides to it. I would say that there's, you know, law enforcement who see forfeiture as a tool to be used to take the profits from illegal activity and to also use that money to fund law enforcement activities. That would be one side. The other side sees forfeiture as something that the government has used improperly, or has the possibility for abuse, because, as I said, historically there was not a requirement that the government prove a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. It's kind of shifted the burden to the owner. So Measure 3 really changed that. And so if you looked at it as people who were pro-forfeiture and anti-forfeiture, obviously Measure 3 would be seen as a victory for those who were against forfeiture. In response to Measure 3, the 2001 legislature passed a couple bills that basically gave, they were House Bill 2429 and House Bill 3642. I've also included those in your packet, the body of those, and a short the staff brief from those. Again, those you can put in your packet and keep in case you want to look at them. To explain basically what they did, I would say House Bill 2429 basically took Measure 3, which related to civil forfeiture, and gave it basically the procedure for it. It basically enacted Measure 3. The other portion, the other bill, is House Bill 3642, and that is when Measure 3 was passed, and there was this, I think, a realization that civil forfeiture was probably not going to be used as much, and was not going to be, certainly was not going to be used in the way it was. There was a look towards criminal forfeiture, and 3642 is a change to criminal forfeiture, which Mr. Chair, you probably remember that one from 2001, and I know Mr. Taylor does, and myself. It was in 2001, because of Measure 3, there was some pressure to have these two sides to this forfeiture issue work together, and realizing that criminal forfeiture would probably use more, there was an ability to have the two sides give and take a little bit, and what we came up with was 3642. To highlight 3642, I would just say that it, one of the main pieces of that was that it dealt with how the proceeds of a criminal forfeiture. So a criminal forfeiture is one that does require a criminal conviction. It typically, I think, that it would be pled into the indictment. And again, this was seen as another avenue to do forfeitures now that Measure 3 was going to really change the civil forfeiture process. That was seen as this avenue that could be used. And the kind of in light of Measure 3 and the way it treated the use of proceeds by law enforcement, 3642 had a split of the proceeds so that money would go to treatment and would be split so that law enforcement wouldn't keep all of it. I believe under 3642, Bud, tell me if this is wrong, but I believe basically it was 40% would be used by law enforcement. And then typically that 40% of the proceeds or the forfeited property would then be split. So say if Portland did a forfeiture, they would split that with the DA's office in Multnomah County to do kind of the legal work, basically. So I think the where you sat after Measure 3 and those two bills is that really law enforcement didn't use forfeitures as much at all. I think in the testimony I looked at from your April hearing, you had testimony from Dave Fidenke from the ACLU and Michelle Burrows, who is a, to my mind, one of the better forfeiture counsel for defense in the state. And you had some testimony that I included, so that's all included in your packet, from the Portland police and from Mark McDonald from the Multnomah County DA's office. And what I would highlight about that is that after Measure 3 and those two bills, really forfeiture is not used as a law enforcement tool very much at all. One of the goals of the statutes that I mentioned was to have forfeiture money fund treatment, drug treatment for folks who are addicted to drugs. Because the I think the way law enforcement would characterize it is that the procedures that are put in place statutorily, they feel are too costly to make forfeitures basically possible for them to do. What that has meant is that the money that was hoped to be able to be used for drug treatment that would have been taken from those forfeiture monies has not been there. We haven't had that money. And I think from the testimony from, I believe it was from Dinah Vidlins, who's a deputy, assistant attorney general. Really, she says there's 78% fewer narcotics task force personnel. So I guess what I'm saying is the upshot of those, of Measure 3 and the Z statutes is there's just not as much forfeiture that's done anymore. But put in your handout how much the value was from 99 to 03, and I think he would say that most of those, but correct me if I'm wrong, most of the ones even from 03 are old cases that are kind of being taken care of. Is that right?
It typically takes at least a year for some of these cases to work through, and some of them may be much older than that. So the amount of money that we receive in a year, we show has been received in a year, may come from cases as old as 6 years before that. So the timeline for these cases is not very easy to piece together. Another issue on the dollar figures here is you won't see these anywhere else in our reports. When Craig asked me originally to provide a list of amounts of forfeiture over the years, I gave him a list with four different alternative totals because we get different kinds of reports. We get a report when a case is concluded by the forfeiture counsel. We get another report when those assets are distributed amongst the various parties. And then we get an annual report from jurisdictions that receive funding from and asset forfeitures, and each of those receive monies in a year from a different time period, so they're not easy to correlate. And we also get a cash amount when the original seizure is made. I think that's probably the first report is probably the one that gives us the most complete information. The others we get successively less compliance and filing rules. And then I gave you some information as well from the first couple of years of forfeiture when there was no staff for the committee. Legislative Council compiled those reports and they just reported kind of cumulative totals to the legislature at that time. So they're not at all comparable, but it just can be used as a general indication of forfeiture activity. But please don't think that those are very reliable figures.
So I feel like my charge from Mr. Taylor and the chair is to give kind of a I'm neither fish nor fowl, this is what law enforcement would say, this is what anti-forfeiture or the folks that feel that that forfeiture was misused, and bring you up to now where the way I see it, here's what the legislature, I think that the choices you might have in the future. The case about Measure 3 is called, it's known as Lintz v. Kitzhoper. And I think the way that I'll try to give the where that case sits now. At the Court of Appeals, Measure 3 was found to violate the single subject rule so that it would be unconstitutional. That is before the Supreme Court now. So here's how I would lay it out. The court will either find that Measure 3 was constitutional or unconstitutional. If Measure 3 is unconstitutional, then the legislature, I believe, will have some choices to make about forfeitures in Oregon. If it's found to be constitutional, then it's a part of our Constitution, and what is embodied there can't be changed by the legislature. So I'm going to just focus on what if it is unconstitutional. If it's unconstitutional, I see kind of three ways to look at this. You would have law enforcement would say the bill that I mentioned that kind of enacted Measure 3, which was House Bill 2429, and then also the bill that dealt with criminal forfeiture, which is 3642, have what's called sunset clauses. And that means that in July of this year, if no action is taken, they will both go away, sunset. And that was done at the time because, again, when those were put together in 01, everyone knew that this was probably going to be litigated. And I think, actually, the timing is, they were fairly correct on the timing and when it would happen. So they each have sunset clauses. So of the three things the legislature could do, one would be do nothing. And those statutes would sunset, Measure 3 would be unconstitutional, and forfeiture would go back to what was done before Measure 3. So that would be to my mind, that would be what maybe law enforcement would want, because that would allow them to go back to what was done in the past. Law enforcement could use the proceeds. The burden of proof would not be on the government, etc. So that's option one. On the other side of the spectrum, if Measure 3 is found unconstitutional, the legislature could still remove those sunsets, and the legislature could say, well, the voters passed Measure 3, and I'm going to, as the legislature, I'm going to say, I'm going to pass the statute. And that would basically keep what we have now. I would remove the sunset, let that law continue on after July of 05. And that would be kind of a win for the anti-forfeiture side or those who feel that forfeiture is misused. So those are kind of the two the two polls. And then if the legislature and this committee, which I presume would be probably the committee that would handle this, could look at a middle approach. And I put in your forfeiture background information, Bud put together a bullet of kind of the issues that you would probably want to have those two parties to discuss and see if they could make some kind of agreement. And those issues would be, should there be a requirement for a conviction of the owner of the property? Should there be a criminal conviction beyond a reasonable doubt that that you would not be able to do a forfeiture without? The next most important issue on this would be how the proceeds are distributed. Because as I mentioned, the way that they're distributed now, I think law enforcement would say we can't do forfeitures because it's too costly, and their costs of, I think what they highlighted in their testimony is, you know, a drug enforcement, when you're not just going after possessors, but actually a drug dealing situation, you know, drug dealing, it takes overtime. Drug dealers don't work 9 to 5, and so you're going to have law enforcement officers on a task force that takes overtime money. So it's expensive. And basically their feeling is their cut of the pie will not cover their expenses. And they still believe that it's a good tool to use to take those profits, and they don't want to be seen as trying to enrich themselves, but they're just unable to do it. And so that the staff that they used to have that would be enable them to do that kind of investigation is gone. So that would be, I think, probably the second most important issue, is if you wanted to do a middle-of-the-road compromise of some kind, that would be probably the second most important one. And then the other ones that I've highlighted are, what should the burden of proof be? Should we review that? Who should the burden have? Should the burden be on the government to prove, or should the claimant to the property have to establish their innocence? Probably the next issue would be the standard of proof. Should it be the standard in a civil case, which would be a preponderance of the evidence, that it's more likely than not? Should it be the clear and convincing proof that I think is in Measure 3, or, of course, beyond a reasonable doubt? And then, obviously, the other issue would be the concept in 2001 when these measures were passed was that some of that money could fund treatment. And so those are probably the issues that you'd want to look at. And I think that, to my mind, things have changed a little bit since 2000 when Measure 3 was passed, as far as I think this the meth epidemic being the main thing. So I guess that I would just leave with that, as I saw the information I wanted to give you was those are basically the options I see. And I think that obviously if in my role as the executive director for the Criminal Justice Commission, if you wish to do the middle road and have some kind of group dialogue about this, I'd be more than happy to help you do that with the help of your counsel or whoever you want me to work with. So with that, if there's any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them.
Mr. Prinz, I have had a discussion with all of the members, and they do want to seek, I think, this middle of the road. I'd like you to work with Representative Olson, a staff person at probably Heidi,
mm-hmm.
and I think Greg Campbell, someone from the police. Probably you're going to have to bring in the other side of the issue,
yes.
People. Make sure they're there and and see if you can't come up with something. And I want that done quickly. I don't want it done in April after the court and we don't have time to get through the process. We want something in place so that we'll have pretty good agreement on what we've got and get it into the process. So make sure that you work with these people to get that done, please.
Yes.
Representative Garage, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. President.
under present conditions, what percentage of the forfeiture funds actually go back to the law enforcement unit for expenses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think the split is 40%, but then they take that and they usually have an intergovernmental agreement with the DA's office who does the legal work, and they'll split that. So in my review of the testimony from Mark McDonnell, who was one of the folks from Multnomah County that worked on this, and some of the Portland police, I would say that the agency, the police agency, usually would keep about 20%. Does that sound about right? So you would be a split of that 40 between the lawyers and the police.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Have one, Greg, on the person who claims an interest, and it says here must file a claim. What is the claim process for them, the costs for them, time frame, and the necessity of having legal counsel to, because of maybe it's complex and that type of thing? I'd like to know that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a good question. One of the things that I think opponents to forfeiture see is that because it's a civil action, there's no right to counsel. It's not like a criminal case. There's no right to counsel. So in the typical case, people don't have an attorney, and they probably don't even attempt to make a claim. I don't know if Bud has numbers on how often when there is a claim, there is a counsel. Do you know?
I think we have some of that information in the annual report that you received in your packet. I couldn't quote you off the top of my head. Changed considerably after Measure 3 because then there had to be the criminal conviction. So frequently, always people would have that opportunity to have an attorney before they could be convicted of the crime. In some cases, though, because forfeiture is so complex and some of the laws and rules are so arcane, you really need an attorney if you're going to challenge this in court. Sometimes there would be an additional attorney retained just for the forfeiture part of the action. And so generally people are represented when they go to court. It's just a question of whether they have a specialist representing them on the forfeiture claim if it's a civil forfeiture case.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's complicated enough that I think it would be very difficult without an attorney. And so that's going to be the real cost. And as far as having someone do it pro se without an attorney, I'd have to review and talk to the experts, and I can get back to you about what the filing fee would be for a claim.
What would be, could a situation develop where someone's trying to get their property back, which has already been seized, and they were not convicted of a crime, and where they may have been found? I got a real problem with someone forking out $20,000 to hire a $50,000 attorney to get back, which might be legally taken in some people's minds, that if they weren't guilty of something, how did you take it to start with?
And Mr. Chairman, I think
that's one of the things I'd like you to address in your group.
I think that's one of the, I mean, the issue, I think what you're addressing is usually what happens on forfeitures prior to Measure 3 was there was just a stipulated agreement that the government would say, hey, we've got $20,000, let's make a deal, which, of course, as a former deputy DA, I mean, plea agreements happen in most criminal cases too, but certainly that was the way that usually would do it, and I'd be happy to look at that type of look at it from that perspective and be glad to work with you and the parties.
I think we probably would agree that we want a process that gives the police the authority and a reasonable way of doing their business, and at the same time protect people's property rights and those who aren't guilty of something too from being overrun by the government, incurring costs that they really shouldn't. It's called justice, in my opinion, anyway.
And Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, I think in working on this before the case, it'll be good to have, you'll have to be the pressure to make sure that the parties work on this. And
you can be assured that there will be pressure.
And one of the other issues that I think we'll look at is the issue from Measure 3, which was law enforcement, and most of the folks believe that you could only forfeit what you could prove. Say that you have someone that has a large amount of money, say $10,000, and then $100 was used by an undercover agent to buy drugs from that person. So you have a person that has $10,000, maybe say a pager and some drug records, and maybe some bundles of meth packaged. So I think strong evidence that, that money was used in some kind of drug dealing.
I think
after Measure 3, most people believe that you could only forfeit the $100 that was used in the buys, because that's the one you can prove was used in that case. And so that's one of the things I think, too, Mr. Chair, if there could be some direction, if you would like to have us look at that type of thing where maybe it's from similar conduct, I think is the way they've looked at it, that I think that's an area that would I hope, okay, be one we could address.
Okay. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Mr. Prinz, we have a sunset on the 2001 responses to Measure 3. What happens if either the decision on the Lint case does not strike down Measure 3, or if there's no decision and we get to the July 31, 2005 sunset date?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair McPherson, okay, let me make sure I understand, and Bill can probably answer this better than I can, but are you saying if there is not a decision at all by then?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. One is that there's no decision, so we're still waiting for,
right,
a decision when that sunset date arrives. Another possibility is the court doesn't strike down Measure 3. They hold that it's all right under the single subject rule.
If Measure 3 is not struck down, I think then it's the law of the land, and we won't be doing anything on it as far as some kind of middle ground. We'll have Measure 3, and as I put it in there, the way it is, which is, that'll be the law. If there's no decision by July of 2005, then my understanding is that Measure 3 would still be the law, and the statutes would sunset. So you would really have a situation where you'd have a law that really doesn't have procedure. Do you know what I'm saying?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I think you're going to the heart of the question, really, which is how effectively is Measure 3 self-implementing, mm-hmm, by its own language? Does it need these statutes to implement it, if they sunset, is it sufficient on its face to be applied effectively?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair, I think it needs implementing language like House Bill 2429, because that really has the procedure. So if you look at Measure 3, I wouldn't say it's broad strokes as far as initiatives go, but it's broad strokes as far as a lawyer trying to figure out how to file a claim, for example, so I think it would require that 2429 to keep it and implement it, and that would sunset July of 2005.
Mr. Chair, what I would suggest is that this same work group then undertake as part of its work, kind of considering what the range of possibilities are, because it sounds like something needs to happen by the end of this legislative session, regardless of whether there's a court decision on Measure 3.
Anything further? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Sue Porter, she's here.
Yes.
Department of Administrative Services, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Porter, and I'm with the Office of Economic Analysis, Department of Administrative Services, and I'm here today to brief you on historical and forecast prison population growth. our office produces semi-annual forecasts of the adult corrections population, which includes prison and community corrections. And we also do a forecast semi-annually of the demand for Oregon Youth Authority closed custody beds. But today I'm just going to be talking about the prison population, and the numbers, forecast numbers I'm going to give you are based on our most recent forecast, which you should have a copy of. That's the October 2004. And Oregon's prison population has grown in the last 10 years by almost 85%. It was 6,900 in January 95, and in January 2005 it was 12,761. We forecast it to grow by 37.5% over the next 9.5 years to reach 17,572 by July 2014. That's the end of our current forecast. On page one of my testimony, there's figure one, the historical and forecast prison population. That chart appears in a lot of places, and it's commonly referred to as the snake. And it shows the population growth for the prison since January 95 and some of the major laws that have come into effect. So shortly after January 95, April 1, 95, Measure 11 went into effect. The prison population went up until January of 97, when the Community Corrections Act or Senate Bill 1145 took effect. Then for about 6 months, the population went down as people with sentences of 12 months or less started serving their time in the community. Then in July of 97, the repeat property offender law, the first of those, took effect. And from that point on, we've had uninterrupted growth. Until July of this year, we've gone through a period of no growth. It's been flat, and that is due to the effect of the alternative incarceration program that was passed in the last session. That's a temporary effect, and I would expect to get back into growth within the next 3 months. So most of the growth that has occurred in the last 10 years is due to Measure 11, and then to a lesser extent the repeat property offender law. We estimate that 60% of the total growth in the prison population between July 95 and July 2004 was the direct or indirect effect of Measure 11. And we estimate that in the future, the coming 10 years, Measure 11 will contribute 43% of the growth that's forecast. For repeat property, we estimate that 15% of the growth between July 98 and July 04 was due to repeat property, and that 8% of the growth in the future 10 years will be from the repo law. The other significant source of growth is in the number of inmates that are serving a sentence of 12.03, or 12 months and one day, to 15 months. And that excluding repo, which would be in that group. So there's another group of people that went from a population of 50 on July 1 of 96 to 380 July 1 of 94. And we think that that's a...
Why would Dave... You know, the judge is aware of where that's going to place that person. Is there some reason we're getting a larger increase in that 12 months to 15 month sentence? Is that to get them to the big house instead of at the county level?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we believe that is a response to Senate Bill 1145, where this type of person before that law would have gone to prison maybe with a 10 or 12 month sentence. Now they would get most often a 13 month sentence. So that they can serve their time in prison. And that happened immediately after that law took effect, and it's continued to grow since then.
Of that growth of Measure 11, you mentioned how that had grown. Is there the substance abuse? Do you have any figures what portion of that growth is due to substance abuse? And then can you measure because there's a substance abuse problem, these people then commit property crimes because of the substance abuse. So the two of them together can drive the prison population. Do you have any measurement of knowing the effect of substance abuse on the whole system?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have heard that Department of Corrections has some statistics about, you know, how many of the people that come to them have substance abuse problems, and I think going from memory, it's 60%. But the data I have is just talking about what the people are convicted of. So,
Right, if you can see if you can't maybe find something or give us a bit of guidance, because if we're going to pass legislation regarding meth and all these other things, we need to know how it's affecting the prison system.
I would say for repeat property offenders, it's very common that they will also have another drug possession or distribution offense along with that.
Thank you.
On page 2, there's table 1 that shows historical and forecast growth by biennium. And starting in with the last biennium, the growth has started to abate somewhat, both in terms of the number of people and the rate. And some of that is that the first Measure 11 people started to get released from prison, and also more recently that alternative incarceration program has slowed growth for the last 6 months. In Table 2, there's just 3 snapshots of the prison population, July 1 of 96, July 1 of 04, and July 1 of 2014. The current population has a smaller percentage of people serving revocations. For the most part, those people go to the county. They're part of the community corrections population now. There's a higher percentage of females, higher percentage of Measure 11 sentenced, and a higher percentage of people age 50 and over. And we expect those trends to continue over the next 10 years, so that by July 2014, there's still even a smaller percentage of revocations and more women, Measure 11 sentenced people, and older inmates.
Okay.
Since Measure 11 is the single greatest driver of prison growth, I was just going to get into a little more detail of how exactly that happens. And it is not from more people coming to prison, it's from their sentence length for the most part. There's some definitions that I should talk about before I launch into this. Measure 11 sentence, when we say that, we're talking about someone serving a mandatory minimum sentence for one of the crimes listed in 137-700. When we say Measure 11 crime, we're talking about people convicted of crimes listed in that section, but they did their crime before the law took effect, so they're serving a sentence that was in effect prior to that under guidelines. And then there's Measure 11 related offenders, which are convicted of a crime that is of the same type as in ORS 137-700, but it's a lesser degree, or it's an attempt. For example, Assault 1 and Assault 2 are Measure 11 crimes, where Assault 1 attempt or Assault 3 is what we call Measure 11 related crimes.
Okay.
And this group also would include people convicted under 137-712, which allows some exceptions to Measure 11. So those are the three groups of people that figure into the impact. In Table 3, you can see that these are people, intakes for Measure 11 crimes or Measure 11 sentence, crimes that are listed in that statute. You can see when the law took effect between 95 and 96 fiscal year, that there weren't more people coming to prison for those crimes. In fact, there are slightly fewer. Over on the next page, on page 3, you look at the change in length of stay between prior to Measure 11, after Measure 11 for the same crimes. The lower line, what this is the percentage of inmates that still remain each month after going to prison. So under the old system, there's a little dot on the bottom axis there at about 37 months. That was the midpoint for people convicted before Measure 11 took effect, convicted of these crimes. The midpoint was about 37 months length of stay in prison. The top line is a sentence for people with a Measure 11 sentence. The midpoint there is 89 months. So that 50-month difference is where the bulk of the impact from Measure 11 comes from to the prison system. And at the end of 10 years, that's the end of our forecast, we still have over 30% of the offenders are still serving a prison sentence, where under the old system, about 15% would be. So there's not only would have a Measure 11 sentence, but it's very common to have, or it's not uncommon to have consecutive Measure 11 sentence or a Measure 11 sentence, and then, you know, like a property offense or a guideline sentence on top of it. The indirect impact of Measure 11 comes from these Measure 11 related crimes, and in that area there are more people coming to prison since Measure 11 took effect. We think that these are the kind of people that would have gotten a probation sentence prior to Measure 11. Now they come to prison, but they don't get the mandatory minimum. The median sentence for these people is about 22 months. And if you turn to page 4, there's a graph at the top. This graph appears in a lot of places, and it's called, commonly referred to as the whale. And this shows the historical and forecast impact on the prison system of Measure 11. The dark area at the bottom, that's an indirect effect, which is pretty much fully implemented now. It's about 850 beds. It's not going to grow anymore. The top part that grows, that's the direct effect from those longer sentences. The other area of growth that may be coming up in the session, some discussion, is female inmates. They have almost doubled the number of them since 96, and we have 41% growth forecast over the next 10 years. And Table 4 shows a snapshot of that population over those same 3 points. A lot of the growth in the number of female inmates recently is from property crimes and drug crimes. I think oftentimes that the person is arrested for property and drug crimes, and then some things are dismissed and some things are pled to. Identity theft in particular has been a real driver of female inmates. And if I look at Department of Corrections data, there's 35% of all the admissions where the major new conviction is identity theft. 35% of those are women. So that's, there's only a few crimes that have such a high degree of female involvement. And so this is one of them, and it's a new one that came into effect in 1999. And then finally, on the next page, this is just kind of an appendix. I thought if we're talking about growth in the future, I would want to know how accurate these forecasts are. And what this chart shows, it just compares our forecasts back to April of 2000, when we began using the model that we have now. It shows those forecasts deviation month by month from the actual population. They're averaged down at the bottom, and then the average over 24 months is below that, since we're funded on a biennial basis. So for the most part, we stay within 1% over 2 years, and for the most part, stay within a percent and a half, you know, up to 5 years. We have forecasts going back farther than that that are quite accurate, but there's a lot more luck involved with those because so many laws have changed. Because of Measure 11, the mandatory minimums, there's no earned time credit, and then beyond that, we have sentencing guidelines, so
for forecasting the prison population, there's a lot less guesswork in knowing when people are going to be released than other states would have that maybe would have a parole system. And then finally, on the last page, are just some other resources that our office has done on the criminal justice and prison system. And I would be happy to answer any other questions.
Any members? Representative Barker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saw a headline today, and I hadn't had a chance to look at that, about a court decision, and somebody said, oh, that's going to take out the minimums. Have you seen that? The Supreme Court came down with a decision yesterday. Will that have any effect? I mean, I don't know what the decision said, so I'm kind of asking two questions. Do you know what it said, and if so, might that mean
let's
something?
Let Mr. Taylor have a little, he's had some conversation.
Mr. Chairman, as the committee, maybe Joe O'Leary could come up too. We've both been looking at this. Fact, Joe looked at the U.S. Supreme Court case yesterday, and maybe he could give the committee an explanation of
please
of
state
the
your name, Joe.
Pardon me?
Make sure you state your name.
It's Joe O'Leary, for the record, counsel to the Judiciary Committee. Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, the case that was announced yesterday it's actually two cases, United States versus Booker and United States versus Fanfan. They were consolidated and put on a fast track to determine whether or not the Supreme Court's decision recent decision in the United States v. Blakely would apply to the United States sentencing guidelines. It's a long decision. It's about 124 pages. It is broken down into two different parts. It's one of those decisions that gives, in my opinion, gives lawyers and law professors kind of a headache because you're trying to figure out which of the justices agree with the other. With that caveat, I'm pretty sure I've got it down, but I might not know all the details.
I would have expected in one day that you had it memorized.
Here's what I think the bottom line is. Blakely, which is essentially the statement of the rule that the Sixth Amendment requires any sentence that is beyond the statutory maximum, any factor that goes to that sentence to be pled and proved to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, that rule applies to the United States sentencing guidelines. That's part one of what Booker and Fanfan says. And there are five justices that agree with that. The other question that Booker and Fanfan answer is, if Blakely applies to the sentencing guidelines, then what happens to the sentencing guidelines? What is the remedy? Because there is no provision right now in the sentencing guidelines for a jury to make determinations about aggravating factors that could increase convicted person's sentence. And five different, almost all different justices, but not entirely, say that the remedy is to make the sentencing guidelines, federal sentencing guidelines, purely advisory. So what that means is that the U.S. sentencing guidelines are no longer binding on federal district court judges. They are merely advisory in nature. The court shall consider those in determining its sentence, but need not follow them. So what it reverts back to is the what we used to call the statutory range, which is the provision of the U.S. Code that says for this kind of felony, the maximum sentence is 20 years. Or perhaps there's another provision that says notwithstanding that maximum sentence, there's a mandatory minimum, like a 5-year or 10-year gun minimum. So the court is still bound by those, but otherwise this is, I think, being seen. And again, it's really preliminary, but I think this is being seen as a huge advance for judicial discretion in sentencing.
Mr. Taylor?
Joe, could you give the committee a little bit of background about Blakely and its impact upon Oregon sentencing guidelines?
Sure. The case on Blakely in Oregon is State versus Diltz. And that was decided relatively recently as well. And that case also consider the same two issues. First, does Blakely apply to the Oregon sentencing guidelines? And the Oregon Supreme Court answered very definitely in the affirmative. The second question was broached, what do we do about it? Because like the federal sentencing guidelines, the Oregon sentencing guidelines do not provide for any sort of consideration by the jury of aggravating factors. In fact, direct the judge to consider those aggravating factors and make a decision about a departure. And what the Oregon Supreme Court did, and my understanding of what the Oregon Supreme Court did, is say that they would not sever the language in the Oregon sentencing guidelines that says the judge has got to make the decision about a departure. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court just said about the federal sentencing guidelines. The Oregon Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to sever that language. That's what the Attorney General's office was urging them to do, and said that there is a way, in their opinion, that the Sixth Amendment can be complied with under the Oregon sentencing guidelines. They didn't go so far as to say what that way is. My read of the opinion is that there is probably an implication that the trial court can convene a sentencing jury to consider those aggravating factors and determine whether or not those aggravating factors are proved beyond a reasonable doubt. But I've now crossed into giving you my estimation of what that opinion means. The opinion is very clear that it is not going there. It wasn't before the court, so they didn't express an opinion on it one way or the other.
Joe, for the committee, could you explain what sentencing guidelines are and then explain what an upward departure is and under what circumstances upward departures are given?
I'm pleased to. Do you mind if I use the chalkboard?
Sure.
No, as no. The key point is that
since I don't have prepared, the sentencing guidelines are represented in what practitioners refer to as the grid, which is a multicolored bingo card, almost looking kind of thing, and it's got two axes. The top is the criminal history axis, and the side axis is the crime seriousness axis. And the crime seriousness, oh, we've got one.
He's trying to preempt you.
It looks like this. So the crime seriousness axis, there is a seriousness level that each felony offense is given, and it's assigned by Mr. Prince's office and in consultation with many others. So for example, a possession of a controlled substance, simple possession of methamphetamine, is typically a level one offense. Anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm doing this on the fly. And then what the court does, and that gives you a number here in the meat of the grid that gives you what the sentence would be for any particular offense. And then what the next thing you do is you look at the criminal history of the person who's being convicted. And that is, again, set out by the grid. And the lowest level is somebody with no criminal history. The highest level is somebody with a significant criminal history, usually of person crimes. And then you find out where your person, if it is your private attorney, you find out where your client lands on the grid. If they've got some person, let's say one person conviction, so they're an F. No, excuse me, they're a D. So that's right about middle to high end. You line up these two things and you get a number. And in this example that I just gave you, the number, it actually doesn't matter what the criminal history is for a level one. The number is all the same. It's a presumptive probation sentence. And a person who's convicted can be sentenced to up to 30 days of jail or up to 90 days of what they call non-jail units, which is to say community service or a restitution center, work release kind of center. And that the grid also provides the term of probation, that is the presumptive term of probation. So that, what I've just explained to you, is the presumptive grid block for a possession of methamphetamine, no matter what the person's criminal history is. Now, if the person happens to have, you know, 20 or 30 possessions of methamphetamine, it's such that they can't get, but no, say no person felony, so they can't go any higher on the criminal history scale, but perhaps the judge is going to sit there and say, you know, this person's criminal history is really severe, and the grid block that's set for this doesn't reflect the severity of the person's record. Then the court can take that into consideration, could take that into consideration, I think no longer, and decide to do a departure sentence. They can do what's called a dispositional departure, which is to say the judge decides, I'm not going to give this person probation, I'm going to send them to prison. And the judge orders a sentence of 13 months, and they go to the Department of Corrections. This is traditionally, under the guidelines, that's been the way it works. And what Blakely says and what Diltz says is that the judge can't make that determination anymore. Now, the judge is bound by that presumptive sentence. There's something different, and that is what is traditionally been called the statutory range, which is Oregon Revised Statute, whatever the number is. I apologize for not having the cite. But that says, in this example, that possession of a controlled substance, the maximum possible sentence is 5 years in prison. So Blakely could have been decided differently to say that the real range is that five-year range under the statute. But instead, what Blakely and what Diltz say is that the real sentence is what the guidelines says it is. The guidelines, it has the force of law, and that's what the sentence is presumptively. And if the court is going to depart from this presumptive grid, it's got to be done in a way that the defendant has notice, and it's got to be done in a way that the jury determines that those facts are proven beyond reasonable doubt. A couple exceptions: if the defendant admits to the aggravating factors and waives the right to a jury, then obviously a jury doesn't need to be convened and decided. Another that's written into Blakely and Diltz is that the person's criminal history does not need to be pled or proved to a jury or even admitted by the defendant.
Further questions?
One more. Mr. Chairman. And when you talk about major 11 related crimes, are you talking about the case where somebody commits a crime that they could be charged under major 11, but instead of getting the 5 years, there's a plea bargain, they say take 24 months? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that's what we believe happens, is that the people are initially charged with the major 11 crime, but then and plea to something less, get prison, but not the mandatory minimum.
Okay, thank you.
Any question, Representative Pearson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Porter, is there an average cost number for incarcerating an inmate in our system in the state per year that would be a useful kind of rule of thumb?
Mr. Vice Chair, I believe that the budget is built on a cost per day, and it is somewhere in the range of $65 a day for a prison inmate. And I think that goes up a little every biennium, but it's somewhere in that range right now. And I could get the exact.
Yeah, we're going to be talking with Max tomorrow. We've got a list of
questions. They don't know the exact, but it's in that range.
We're going to ask and include that.
All right. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So just kind of doing some rough math, that sounds like it's somewhere in the area of $25,000 per year to incarcerate someone. So I'm just looking at this chart here on page 2 of your testimony, and it says that between July of 1995 and the last projection date of July of 2013, there'd be a nearly 10,000 inmate population increase. And if I'm doing the mathematics right, that means that's $250 million more per year being spent at the end of the projection period than at the start on incarcerating offenders in Oregon. Is that a sort of in general ballpark terms an accurate statement of where we are or where we're headed?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair McPherson, are you talking about the entire?
Well, I want to make sure that I'm reading the table right. I mean, I'm seeing on the table on page two, the first population figure for prison population is 7539, and the end in July 2013 is 17205. So I just
right.
Kind of simple math. I'm taking about a 10,000 inmate increase over that period, and then when I multiply that by $25,000 per year to incarcerate them, that means we're projecting to spend $250 million per year at the end of the projection period than when we did at the beginning of the period on incarcerating offenders in the state.
That sounds right.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Porter.
Any further questions? And you have completed your presentation.
Thank you.
Before we adjourn, I'd like to give Representative Thatcher a chance to tell us a little about herself.
I'll tell you very little. I don't want to keep you. Representative Thatcher, representing Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh, and I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just want to remind everyone about the trip to the state prisons tomorrow. We're leaving on a bus outside at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then on Monday, we will have a meeting. We have two bills scheduled on Monday morning at 8:30 for the civil subcommittee. Immediately following the civil subcommittee will be a meeting of the full committee.
Okay, thank you, and we're adjourned.